Here for the Lowe's early Black Friday deals? You're right on time for some of our biggest savings. We're talking up to 50% off select major appliances, plus up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. Holiday lights going up soon? Select ladders are up to 50% off right now. Get Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 11/19. Selection varies by location. Select locations only. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details. Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help you save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
Okay, so if you are looking for a tale that perfectly marries just the spectacular horror of a modern reality show with the sheer impossibility of historical fact,
Well,
you have definitely landed in the right place. We are diving deep today into a legend that, honestly, it gives us instant whiplash every time we try to pin down its timeline. It's really something.
And that whiplash, starts right away, right from the get-go with the thesis statement we pulled from the source material, which, I mean, talk about a perfect chilling hook. Just states, this was one of the first TV shows ever, and it was pure evil. Simple as that.
Wow. Yeah, that opening line, it immediately sets the stage, doesn't it? For the narrative we are tackling. The legendary account of Dandelions and the Wheel of Beasts. It's a story where the spectacle is lethal, the moral stakes couldn't possibly be higher, and the host, this Dandelions character, he functions as the ultimate ringmaster of human despair, really.
Yeah.
We are dealing with a legend that captures the very essence of high-stakes cruelty, but it's all wrapped up in this, well, impossible packaging of late 19th century broadcast media.
And that packaging, the technological and historical impossibility, that's the core tension we absolutely have to address head on. Because the moment we assign a date to this show, the late 1890s, we introduce this massive, almost, you know, fantastical historical anachronism. It just screams out at you. We are talking about a time when the infrastructure, the physics, I mean, even the basic electronics required to broadcast anything remotely resembling a mass audience television show. It simply did not exist, not even conceptually, really.
Absolutely. And that's our mission today, right?
Yeah.
To unpack this tale by systematically separating the terrifying nature of the spectacle, the powerful narrative motifs of human cruelty.
Yeah.
That's what we call the myth. Separating that from the cold, hard, logistical impossibilities of the entire setup. That's the method. We will demonstrate how the sheer audacity of the anachronism itself, it actually acts as a pertinent marker. It defines this legend, signaling to, you know, the modern audience exactly what anxieties this story is really tapping into.
Yeah, we'll meticulously follow the show's dark, almost unbelievable premise. We'll analyze the massive deceptive lie contestants were apparently sold. And then we'll really slow down to examine the explosive confrontation with the single person who, the story goes, actually survived this thing. By the time we are done, you'll realize, I think, that the most powerful lies in this story aren't really about the animals in the cages. They are about the history itself. It's a distortion.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Let's start with that impossible premise. The central image of this legendary show is just incredibly visceral, isn't it? It remains the strongest part of the narrative. Dandelions, the host, standing next to this massive, imposing wheel. And this wasn't some game show prize wheel dispensing, you know, small fortunes or trinkets. It was literally described as a wheel of death, covered with the names of terrifying wild animals. Lions, tigers, bears.
Mm-hmm. And the visual setup is absolutely essential to the enduring power of the myth. You have to picture it. You have the poor, desperate contestant, probably someone down on their luck, driven by just extreme financial need, eyes fixed on this huge turning mechanism of fate. It's dramatic. They are watching to see which beast, which, you know, sheer force of nature their next 24 hours of survival would depend upon. It's presented as this literal lottery of life and death, staged with all the ceremonial, brutal flair of some kind of public event.
And the challenge itself was, well, elegantly simple in its brutality and just absolute in its consequence. Whatever the wheel landed on, the contestant would be locked into a secured box or cage with that animal for exactly 24 hours. Full stop. The source material really emphasizes the high-stakes nature of this challenge, suggesting, almost promising, that the audience was tuning in specifically for guaranteed lethal failure. This positions the Wheel of Beasts as the absolute epitome of exploitative media, where the unspoken contract with the viewer is basically guaranteed tragedy.
But we have to pivot here, right? From the high drama of the challenge to the cold, hard facts of the stakes versus the reality of the historical time frame. Because the prize offered for surviving this 24-hour ordeal was the truly staggering sum of $1 million. $1
million. $1 million. In the late 1890s, I mean, even just saying it out loud sounds like a typo, right?
Yeah.
Like a mistake in the history books.
It is far more than staggering. It's actually a critical, cold fact that immediately marks this entire story as either, you know, a modern legend projected backward in time, or maybe an intentional narrative device meant to emphasize the sheer extremity of the risk. We really need to ground this in 1890s economic reality to truly measure the absurdity. It's almost comical if it weren't so grim.
Okay, so lay out the context for us. Yeah. Just how absurd are we talking here? What did $1 million mean back then?
Right. Well, in the late 1890s, $1 million represented an almost unfathomable valuation for a single person to earn, just out of this world. For perspective, the average annual income for a working class individual in the U.S. was likely hovering around maybe $400 to $500 a year total. A highly skilled professional like a doctor or lawyer might pull in $2,000 a year, maybe a bit more. So to put $1 million in context, think about the industrial titans of the age. Andrew Carnegie, one of the wealthiest men in the world. His entire net worth, while vast, wasn't infinitely larger in scale compared to that prize. $1 million back then was enough money to purchase significant chunks of prime real estate in Manhattan, or maybe establish a substantial industrial enterprise from scratch.
Wow. So this prize money wasn't just get-rich money, it was change-your-family-lineage for centuries money. It was wealth on a scale that few people could even properly conceptualize at the time.
Exactly. This prize amount, it's just not realistic for a period where there were no personal income taxes, and wealth accumulation, while astronomical for some, was incredibly concentrated. The sheer financial exaggeration, it really enhances the legend's scope. It underscores the extreme desperation that would supposedly compel someone to sign up for what amounts to a likely death sentence. It tells us that the core purpose of the myth here is to emphasize the ultimate temptation against the ultimate risk, the biggest carrot imaginable.
Yeah, that financial absurdity serves the narrative beautifully, doesn't it? It makes the contestant's choice seem both completely tragic and, within the context of the myth of the ultimate payoff, strangely understandable.
Right, but okay, well, the dollar amount is one massive, glaring anachronism. The entire medium of the show is the primary, the defining contradiction here. The source repeatedly describes this as a fully functional TV show running in the late 1890s, meaning, you know, a continuous broadcast received simultaneously by a mass audience.
Technologically, yeah. That just didn't exist, flat out.
Not even remotely close. We have to be really clear about the logistical impossibility here. Television technology, as we understand it, you know, the ability to capture a live moving image, encode it electronically, transmit it over vast distances, and then have consumer sets capable of decoding and displaying it, that was fundamentally missing. Decades away, this was the era of the kinetoscope, which was basically a people viewing device for one person at a time, and very, very early grainy short motion pictures shown in specific venues. Actual broadcast was decades away. The entire framework of sufficient electronics, bandwidth, signal transmission, receivers, everything necessary to make The Wheel of Beasts a TV show in, say, 1899 simply did not exist. It's science fiction for that time.
It's not just that the technology was primitive. The entire scientific and engineering pathway to mass broadcast hadn't even been fully conceived, let alone secured. So, the methodologist in me has to emphasize that the core premise is technologically impossible, just full stop. Yet, the mythologist in me kind of accepts it, because that very impossibility is what gives the story its legendary weight. It allows it to function as a critique of modern media, ironically.
Precisely. Think about it. If this were merely some cruel spectacle happening in a hidden basement somewhere, or maybe a remote circus tent on the outskirts of town, it would be a localized, horrifying crime. Awful, but contained. But by calling it a TV show in 1899, the legend instantly elevates the crime. It makes it a form of broadcast, systematic, almost corporate evil, watched by many. The anachronism functions as a deliberate marker, like a secret handshake, telling us, the modern audience looking back, that this cruelty was systemized, monetized, and viewed passively by a mass audience. Which, you know, perfectly reflects our current anxieties about media exploitation and maybe the normalization of cruelty online or on TV today.
Okay, so moving beyond the impossible technology and that impossible prize, let's look closer at the actual mechanism of cruelty. The thing that supposedly made the show so horrific, the animal selection itself was brutal. The source lists the absolute staples of terror. Lions, tigers, grizzly bears were apparently among the regular choices on the wheel. And the core narrative element here is simple and just unrelenting. Nobody ever won, period.
Yeah. The narrative hammers home this theme of spectacle as the ultimate form of cruelty. The premise essentially ensures that the audience is watching people knowingly enter a death trap. This wasn't framed as merely a challenge with a tiny, minuscule chance of success. It was structured, guaranteed execution presented as entertainment. And it relies on the predictable desperation generated by that outrageous promise of wealth.
And the manipulation, the story claims, went even deeper than simply choosing lethal animals. It wasn't just bad luck on the spin. The story details the show's darkest secret. A deliberate, calculated engineering of this scenario to absolutely ensure failure, removing even the slightest possibility of, say, a draw or a momentary lapse in the animal's aggression.
That's right. According to the legend, before every single competition, the wild animals, the grizzly bears, the tigers, the lions were intentionally kept hungry, starved, essentially. This fact is stated quite clearly in the source. The lack of feeding wasn't an oversight. It was a critical component of the production design. This single detail, if true within the legend, removes any element of chance or, God forbid, fair competition. The animals weren't just dangerous. They were specifically motivated by intense starvation and desperation, primed for attack.
Wow. Okay, so that detail transforms the entire show, doesn't it? From a high-risk game, however horrific, into an outright scheduled execution disguised by the, you know, the theatrical elements of a competition or a game show. It's the ultimate act of rigging the game. Mm-hmm. And what enabled Lions to convince people to participate in something so clearly lethal? How did they get signups? It must have been the immense deception practiced on the contestants themselves.
Yeah, the sheer audacity of the lie is what makes the cruelty so profound in this telling, because it preys not just on people's desperation, but also on their gullibility, or maybe their willingness to believe an illusion. Contestants were apparently told that the ferocious beast they faced, the one pacing and growling in the darkened cage right in front of them, was nothing more than an actor in a costume.
Okay, I have to stop you there. Seriously, wouldn't anyone, particularly back in the 1890s, when people probably had more immediate or at least recent ancestral experience with the wilderness and real animals, wouldn't they smell the reality of a starving grizzly bear? Mm-hmm. Or just see it? How could that lie possibly hold up?
That's a crucial question, right? It gets into the psychological warfare aspect of the show, as the legend presents it. To understand how people might have signed up, we have to remember the context of 1890s entertainment. This was, like, the golden age of traveling stage magic, fantastic hoaxes, P.T. Barnum-style spectacle where the audience almost expected to be fooled, or at least thrilled by the possibility of being fooled. People were accustomed to elaborate theatrical tricks, sometimes cheap disguises, costume performers in vaudeville shows. Illusion was part of the entertainment landscape.
Okay. So the producers were actually leveraging the public's existing faith in stagecraft and illusion, turning that against them.
Precisely. According to the story, they preyed on the belief in theater to disguise this horrifying reality. They convinced the contestants that the roars were just sound effects, maybe piped in, and the sheer size and ferocity of the animal was merely a clever, perhaps oversized, state-of-the-art suit for the time. The source notes that this lie was just enough to make them feel safe enough to sign up, believing they were participating in a highly lucrative, maybe slightly dangerous, but ultimately theatrical event, not a guaranteed death sentence. This establishes the show's profound moral decay. It reportedly exploited the very notion of artistic make-believe, of performance, for cold-blooded murder.
That lie. That's the show's moral pivot point, isn't it? It suggests that the entire system, Dandelion's whole production, knew its actions were monstrous and actively relied on a theatrical falsehood to lure in its victims. It's deeply cynical.
And if the lie told to the contestants wasn't enough protection, the show reportedly covered itself with a layer of legal fiction that is perhaps the most obviously modern anachronism of all. Even more than the TV itself, maybe. We are referring to the required ritual that reportedly occurred before the start of every single broadcast. A legal fig leaf.
Yes, the disclaimer. A message that would flash on screen. A formal legalistic defense seemingly designed to deflect any accountability. All events in this show are fictional.
And the dramatic irony here is just immense because the legend immediately contradicts it, right? It tells the listener, tells you the truth. It wasn't fictional. It was horrifyingly real. The placement of that lie, the official legal denial right next to the supposed formal truth of the televised murder, makes the cynicism of the show's producers all the more potent and, frankly, painful to contemplate.
Yeah, this is where the story truly reveals its contemporary anxieties, I think. The methodologist side has to step in again and analyze the timing of these supposed legal guardrails. We are talking about the genesis of legal liability in mass media, and this just doesn't fit the 1890s.
Indeed. It's a clear double anachronism. Not only did TV broadcasts not exist in the 1890s, but neither did the specific institutionalized need for broadcast-specific studio legal disclaimers that we now associate with reality TV or maybe horror programming or even satirical shows today. Think of the disclaimers you see before a found footage horror film. This production contains staged events or based on fictional events, that kind of thing.
Right. So back in 1899, if you were actually staging a legal circus act or some kind of deadly public spectacle, you wouldn't precede it with a written legal statement about its fictional nature on a non-existent TV screen. No. You might simply, you'd be arrested for murder if caught.
Precisely. The inclusion of a legal disclaimer in this story, essentially waving its hands and saying, don't sue us, this is just pretend, while simultaneously, supposedly, executing people on air. It points directly to the story being a commentary on modern media accountability, or the perceived lack thereof. It strongly suggests the story was likely formulated much, much later, reflecting a pretty cynical understanding of corporate loopholes and media liability, and then it got inserted back into a time when such disclaimers were utterly irrelevant to broadcast media, because broadcast media didn't exist. It is a very modern fear, isn't it? The fear of powerful institutions hiding behind legal technicalities while engaging in monstrous behavior.
It's the ultimate narrative critique, really. A critique of a system that attempts to erase its own guilt by simply stating, this didn't happen, even as the supposed evidence is broadcast live to a mass audience. Denial is policy.
And we can connect this motif, you know, the lying disclaimer, to similar narrative mechanisms we've analyzed in other legends where the denial itself becomes the proof. It's a recurring theme. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really echoes the powerful central irony found in the legend of Klaus Richter, the figure known as Der Schatten, or the Shadow.
Right. Remind the listener of that core narrative device. How did denial work there?
Okay, so the legend of Der Schatten focuses on this soldier, Klaus Richter, who supposedly commits some unforgivable, highly classified crime during wartime. And the military apparatus attempts to completely eliminate him from history. They deliberately erase Richter from every single record. Photos are snipped or doctored. Documents are destroyed or redacted. His name is deleted from every roster, every manifest. The official statement basically becomes, Klaus Richter never existed. He's a non-person.
But because the erasure was so absolute, so systematic, and apparently so aggressively enforced, the very attempt to deny his existence became the definitive proof that he was real and that he must have posed some significant, verifiable threat. The cover-up proved the crime.
Exactly. The missing data proved the reality. The void screamed his name. And in the context of the Wheel of Beasts, the official attempt to deny reality, that fictional disclaimer supposedly flashing on screen, is precisely what validates the underlying truth of the horror within the story's logic. It's a powerful narrative tool suggesting that the cover-up, the explicit lie of denial, is actually proof of the crime itself. The story demands that the audience recognize that official denials are often confirmation in disguise.
And all of this darkness, this layered deception, this calculated manipulation, it all led to this undeniable pattern of lethal failure, a perfect, horrifying system that guaranteed the producer's wealth and the contestant's death.
Mm.
Until the impossible happened again, but in the other direction. We have to address the breakthrough. The moment the entire carefully constructed system buckled under its own narrative weight, the exception that proves the rule, maybe.
Yeah, the day given in the legend is 1899, and the man's name was apparently Moe deGrasse. The source states he not only survived the entire 24-hour challenge, but did so against a starving grizzly bear, one of the toughest draws, presumably. He became the first and crucially the only person to ever win that impossible $1 million prize, the one single data point that breaks the pattern.
Moe deGrasse. He must have been portrayed as a man of almost supernatural endurance or cunning, maybe, or perhaps just possessing a level of luck that completely defied probability. The narrative requires the audience to believe in one ultimate outlier. The person who somehow breaks the unbeatable system.
And what stands out immediately here is the image, the visceral reaction of Dandelions upon realizing his dark streak of guaranteed failure was finally broken. The source says Lyons was furious, just livid. Now, this fury isn't just some petulant response of a sore loser. It's described more like the raw panic of a criminal whose perfectly designed, foolproof system has suddenly produced an astronomical, unforeseen expense. He actually has to pay. The architect of Guaranteed Misery suddenly had to face the ultimate consequence of his own high-stakes game, the million-dollar check.
Yeah, that anger, it has to transcend the monetary loss, right? It's about the rupture of the spectacle itself. Lion's entire brand, his whole dark persona, was built on lethal failure and the certainty that the audience was tuning in to watch someone die. That was the promise. Mot de Grâce surviving. That undermines the entire dark, exploitative contract he supposedly had with his audience. It threatened his legitimacy as the ringmaster of death. Someone beat the house.
And Lyons immediately, apparently, tried to avoid the massive payout by leveraging the contestants' assumed financial desperation one last time. It just proves his ingrained moral corruption, according to the story. He offered Mo a double or nothing challenge, a chance at potentially $2 million if he'd just risk his life again against another animal. Go back in the box.
But Mo refused, flat out. He was not interested in more money at that point.
No, the story says he was enraged. Enraged that he had been lied to, nearly killed, and realized the whole thing was a sham.
The risk was absolutely no longer worth the reward, especially since he now possessed the undeniable, horrifying truth. He'd seen behind the curtain, he had survived the physical trial, and now he began the moral confrontation. He wasn't playing Lion's game anymore.
And this refusal, it marks the decisive shift in the power dynamic. Mot de Grâce, the first man to win this horrific challenge, supposedly walked away from potentially $2 million. He chose instead to prioritize exposure, maybe revenge, maybe just justice, over ultimate wealth. That's a powerful turning point.
So, Mot confronts Dandy Lyons directly, shouting, the story says, that he would expose the show's dark secret, its murderous deception, to the public. He threatened to dismantle the entire foundation of Lyons' illicit empire.
And this confrontation, this refusal to be bought off or intimidated, led directly to the host's swift downfall. It provides the perfect, almost too perfect, dark poetic justice that the legend demands for a villain of this magnitude. In his consuming fury and desperation, Lyons apparently lunged at Mo, likely intending to silence him, maybe physically, or at least intimidate him into accepting the double or nothing deal to save the money.
But he missed. Just miss. And in that simple momentary failure of coordination, perhaps fueled by rage, Dandy Lyons committed his final fatal error. He lost his footing near the set dressing, near the mechanisms of his own show, and fell exactly 15 feet. The legend is specific about the height. Fell right into the very bare box he had constructed and relied upon for his entire gruesome career, the actual cage.
The final, horrifying image is crystal clear, isn't it? A perfect culmination of the legend's internal moral argument. Lyons falling into his own trap, into the cage intended for the desperate contestants he exploited. And the source adds the chilling final detail. This time, the bear wasn't friendly, implying, well, the obvious.
It is. It's a flawless narrative arc in terms of structure. The system designed to exploit others ultimately and literally consumed its creator. The architect of the spectacle became the final victim of his own cruelty, ensuring a kind of grimly satisfying justice for the listener, for the audience of the legend itself. This narrative mechanism, it feels profoundly resonant, right? You see it across various urban legends and moral tales.
That's absolutely right. If we call back to the deep mythological structure, this mirrors the kind of structural integrity found in, say, the legend of Monopoly that we've discussed before. Remember, in that legend, the game doesn't just entertain. It actively trains you before it pays you, forcing the player to internalize the ruthless systems of debt, property accumulation, and greed. Dandy Lyons designed a closed, lethal system of exploitation, and in the end, that system performed its function flawlessly, just on the unintended target. The rules he wrote were absolute, even tragically for him.
And that perfect structural integrity, that neatness of the legend, is precisely why it holds such power, I think. Even though the logistics, the dates, the technology are entirely demonstrably impossible, it functions as a potent warning about the unintended, often self-destructive consequences of monstrous greed and unchecked power.
So we have spent this time analyzing this really spectacular tale from two deeply intertwined angles, haven't we? The methodologist in me has highlighted the impossible dates, the non-existent technology of 1890s TV, that absurd $1 million prize valuation that just defies historical economics, and the totally anachronistic legal disclaimers that belong to a much, much later era of media critique. Every external detail, every historical marker just screams, fiction. It couldn't have happened this way.
I mean, the mythologist in me highlighted the incredibly powerful narrative, the sheer moral horror of corporate lies that prey on financial desperation, and that satisfying, almost symmetrical, poetic justice of the villain falling victim to his own wicked design. Every internal detail screams moral truth, or at least contemporary warning. It feels true on a different level.
The story of dandelions and the Wheel of Beasts, while, you know, historically bunk, holds a powerful mirror up to our enduring fascination with high-stakes, ethically questionable reality entertainment. And that fascination certainly didn't start in the 1890s, but it maybe finds a dark root there in our imagination. It speaks to our deep, perhaps modern fear that the wealthy and the powerful might literally be betting on our failure and hiding behind theatrical tricks and legal loopholes while they do it.
So why does this specific story, one so clearly fake on the surface, yet so meticulously detailed in its cruelty and its mechanism of denial, why does it hold such lasting power?
I think it's because it captures a profoundly cynical modern truth, or maybe a modern fear, about the price of spectacle and the length powerful institutions might go to deny their own responsibility. It is a tale of systemic horror that really needed the packaging, the anxieties of the 20th or 21st century to be fully understood, even if it was dressed up in 19th century clothes.
It's the perfect synthesis, in a way. Historical impossibility meeting moral certainty. A legend for our times, projected backwards. The screen said fiction, but the numbers and dates say myth.
The studio lights still lit long after the grizzly bear finished its part.
At the UPS store, we know being a small business owner means holiday time is still go time. Still get those orders shipped time and still re-up on stamps and supplies time. That's why this upcoming holiday, while others close up shop, we'll be open and happy to help you keep being unstoppable. Come into your local store today. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. The UPS store. Be unstoppable.